Park Place Pastoral Center, Saturday morning, 11th May 1974. Yesterday, we began to obtain some glimpse of the deep meaning and the extensive, all-inclusive scope of mindfulness. We began to see that mindfulness is not merely a superficial intellectual observation hemmed in by all our conditioning, by our particular viewpoints, and by the limitations imposed upon us because of our own life experience, which necessarily is not the life experience of all mankind. And so we saw that mindfulness in its fullness means that mind, the universal something, this universal transcendent energy or power, comes into operation in us when the psyche is perfectly pure and what we commonly call our mind, our own mind, is empty of all obstructions and is transparent to the light. We saw that when this happens, then we are mindful of every sense impression, of every object, of all ideas, of all people, of all situations, in their wholeness and not in their particularity. Not merely in their particularity. The mindfulness becomes all-inclusive. It becomes a continuous living process from moment to moment. And in that mindfulness is involved what we call healing in the full sense of the word. And also involved in that is the fact that we see the truth of things as they are in the immediate moment. And that seeing the truth always includes the right immediate action, right down to physical action on our part, as and when the necessity arises. Now this seems to me to be mindfulness in its depth and in its fullness. You will see how intensely this is a living process, life in its fullness, operating through us as human beings. And this means that we, as individuals, separate individuals, have come to human fruition, to the realization of the unlimitedness of mind. Recall what we have considered already in this connection. Our growth and our maturing means the emergence out of limitedness into the infinite. Do not regard this infinite in terms of size, measurement. It's very natural for us to do so. When we are taught mathematics at school, infinite means something uncountably large, immeasurably large. But infinite, in its actual meaning, means that which is not limited. Therefore, that which is not measurable. Therefore, that which does not come into being and pass away. Birth and death are completely overleaped. And our awareness of existence in terms of mortality, which is our common mode of awareness, is transformed into the mode of awareness of existence immortally, deathlessly. There is no beginning, no ending. There is only continuous transformation taking place. See, one of the deep implications of this, the fear of death as the end of all things goes out. The fear of death underlies all other fear that we have. All other fears spring out of the fear of death as the root fear, whether we are conscious of it or not conscious of it. With this growing realization of the nature of the infinite, all grasping of the self as an entity also disappears. Because there is no separate self to grasp then. The realization of infinity means also the realization that I am not a finite particular. I am a transforming particular. And in the culmination of this process of transformation, this particular, this being, becomes the totality, the non-being, no separate identifiable entity. And so when we cease to grasp, to hold on to separate identifiable entity, then the realization of immortality is here, together with its peace, together with its fearless state, together with the state in which we are free of all self-oriented personal desire. Then what room is there for any sort of depression? Any sort of feeling that, oh, this is such a difficult task, it's not for me, it will take time, and so on. When you put your finger on the switch and turn on the light, how much time does it take to light up the dark room? What room is there for the darkness of depression then, when you have turned on that switch which sparks off immortal life. But this is a culmination, admittedly. And a culmination implies that there is the passage of time. Of course, there is chronological time. The seconds tick away. The whole cosmos is constructed in that way. And it is constructed in that way, and time is a reality in the cosmos, because the movement of each particular part of the cosmos, the galaxies, the stars, the suns and the planets and their moons and so forth, that movement has a pattern. That pattern is a measurable pattern. And so, time is one, chronological time is one of the mechanical measures devised by man to make himself aware of that pattern and to deal with it in practical affairs. So there is time. There is also psychological time. And this psychological time depends upon our mood, upon our feelings, upon our mental reactions to the external stimulus or to the stimulus caused by memory or by states of anxiety within ourselves and so forth. And because we are subjected to psychological time so very strongly, we feel elated or we feel depressed. Depression means that time is moving all too slowly. Fear means that time is moving in a different way again, and so forth. Now, this problem of depression is quite a serious problem with all of us. It causes considerable distress in the spiritual life, considerable sorrow. A sorrow and a distress so deep reaching into ourselves that the Buddha speaks of it when he talks about entering the third jhana, as it is called, the third stage of meditation. Remember that the second stage is already one of the most tremendous leaps out of worldliness and mortality into the realm of reality and immortality. That second one is. We'll talk about that in detail a little on another occasion. But in this third jhana, there is still the presence of sorrow. And it is only when both sorrow, which will include depression, which will include doubts, fears, intellectual distress, it is only when all these together with their counterpart of rapture, of happiness, of a peaceful happiness, all go down, that one enters into that state of perfect mindfulness, as he calls it, purified mindfulness, clear consciousness, and absolute equanimity, perfect poise. So this element of depression, of inward hurt, of fear, of feeling, oh, this is too much for me, let's give it all up and be normal human beings. All that feeling persists right up to the end. If we may allow ourselves the analogy of climbing a ladder, we must remember that there is the possibility of slipping at any rung of the ladder. And you will see. No, none of you, I think, can question this. The higher up you go, and when you reach the last rung of the ladder, you're in the worst possible position. The darkness is deepest, spiritually. You all know how the great mystics have talked of the dark night of the soul. This dark night of the soul comes on all rungs of the ladder. And each darkness is darker than the previous darkness. And it is more hurtful, it is more terrible, it is more lonely. None of us can escape that. And on the last rung itself, the final experiencing of this takes place. On that last rung, you've got your finger on the switch, which will turn on the current of that equanimity, that inward stability, due to the fact that you're not holding on, that you're not on solid foundations, but due to the fact that you're utterly free now of all defilements of the mind. And then there is only light. There is only peace. There is only the state of perfect mindfulness and equanimity. But one has to go through all this. One can't give it up. One cannot turn back once you've set your feet on the spiritual path. Try it. Try and give it up. Experiment, deliberately experiment that way. Try and give it up. You will find that the hound of heaven will never let you go. And do you know why? Not because the hound of heaven is outside in heaven. He is inside each one of us. Once this stir has taken place within the heart of a man, within the heart of a man, that is within the innermost depths of mind in him, then that stir, which is in line with omnipotence, must of necessity ultimately win. If we talk in terms of conflict, of battle, it will never let you go. There are some of us, at least, if not all of us, who know this from personal experience. try and let go because of the lure of the senses of pleasure, because of the misfortune of success in worldliness. Try it because one is tired, battered by life, weary, hurt too much, and so forth. You will find that this inward light, once lit, can never be extinguished. It is your power of salvation, just as the instrument of your salvation is your power of attentiveness, of mindfulness. They are there within us. They constitute our being. How shall we get rid of them? It's not possible. And it is tragic folly to try to run away from reality, from the saving, the gracious truth of our inmost being. You remember words which express an identical truth spoken both by the Buddha and by Jesus. Be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. The word overcome is used by both of them. The Buddha said, I have overcome all evil things. That was his exact phrase. And Jesus said, I have overcome the world. And in this fathom-long body of ours is the world comprised. And all evil things, as we call them, are also in this fathom-long body. And in the transformation into good, into the absolute good, by becoming free of all the defilements, this fathom-long body, which contained all the evil things, which contained all the misery and difficulty which is represented by the unregenerate world, is transformed into the temple in which lives the ever-benign, the ever-auspicious one. You yourself, if you like to use that Zen phrase, you will see your original face, clear, peaceful, shining with light, radiating, calm. The real joy that has nothing to do with excitement or pleasure or sensational pursuit. So depression will come whilst we are still in the imperfect condition. Fear will overtake us. Anxiety will seize us. And they will keep on coming again and again. And they keep on coming again and again. There is a repetitiousness, a wearisome repetitiousness about it, because we are still subject to time. Now I'm not referring to chronological time there. I am referring to the fact that we are still subject to our particular desires, our ambitions, our urges, our longings, our graspings, whether they be for the obviously evil things in human life, or whether they be for cultural things, beautiful things, noble things, all comprised within the sphere of mortality, or if they be for God, for Nirvana, for the kingdom of heaven, whatever you like. But they are grasping. And therefore, we are subject to time. Because our sense of the time span involved disappears when at last we believe we have grasped what we sought. But look at the illusion which captures us then. We say we have found the end of things, the prize, the fruition, and so forth. And how long does that elation, that self-satisfaction, that spiritual smugness, how long does it last? A year? A month? An hour? A split second? And then there is the new grasping. The worm within us is once again at play, proving that we are but moving corpses consumed by the worms which we ourselves generate. Does it make you feel disgusted when I say a thing like that? Good if it does, because then when you read the Pali's texts, you will understand why that peculiar phrase is used again and again. And so the bhikkhu turns away with disgust from such things. So, we are once again subject to time because we have grasped at something. When that grasping is gone, which means all personal desire has gone, completely out, then there is spiritual strength, to use the theistic phrase, the will of God begins to function because my desire is out. Thy will, not mine, O Lord, be done. That is what we speak aloud. That is what the lips mutter. But what does the voice of the heart, which is still my heart, say? My will, not thine, O Lord. I want it thus and thus. That is why I seek this, that, and the other. In the name of God, of course. But when all that is really out, because one has seen so clearly that there is not an atom of darkness anywhere in the seeing, when that happens, then at last, my desire, or let me put it this way, that psychical energy within me, which operated in the shape of personal desire and grasping, is completely transformed into true virya, strength, power. It's the will of the divine functioning through you. I'm using the word divine. Use any other word you like. The universal energy, pure mind, the cosmic force, the creative power. Call it anything you like. Never mind the name. So long as you understand or at least thrill in response to the inner reality. So, be of good cheer. I don't mean by that make the welkin ring with song and dance and bring the roof down or that sort of thing and disturb everybody else. I don't mean that. But be of good cheer. Free of this evil type of doubt where you are uncertain within yourself. Should it be this? Should it be that? Put aside all that doubting. Just look at it. Look at the situation and try and see what it is. Don't start questioning, am I right or wrong? Don't believe I am wrong, because then you'll still be struggling. Don't believe I am right, because the moment you've said I am right, you are saying I am right to a particular set of mental constructs which you've made at the moment. They'll be your jailers from the very next moment onwards. The moment you fossilize something in the mind like that, it has become your jailer. You see, the path of the yogi, the training of the yogi is one which is calculated to bring him to the state of perfect elasticity, of perfect resiliency, which means that he sees so truly that his psychophysical organism no longer obstructs adapting itself to the truth of his vision in the immediate moment. This is one of the deep, profound meanings attached to the psychophysical discipline of the postures and what is commonly called breathing, pranayama. The breath rhythm is just a fraction of the whole of pranayama. Prana is life. And as far as the maintenance and the continued existence of the physical body is concerned, breath, of course, is the final indispensable. You can give up food, you can give up drink, you can be deprived of sleep for a long time, you can be deprived of physical exercise, movement, and still continue to live, but be deprived of breath, and you've had it. So, that is the physical aspect. But prana is life in its totality. And pranayama means not just the control of life, but being in tune with life. When you breathe rhythmically, and I'm now once again talking about the purely physical aspect. When you breathe rhythmically, you bring the whole body into a tuned condition, like a violin well tuned. And then In that state, your every action is in harmony with your breath rhythm, and your breath rhythm is in harmony with your action. That means the life energy is functioning harmoniously through the body and the body's actions. Now take this into every sphere of one's being, the psychological sphere, the intellectual, the aesthetic, and the spiritual, dealing with meditation and all that sort of thing. Then you will understand what pranayama means. And you will also understand the deepest meaning involved in the yama part of pranayama. A mortification. Which means that your whole life process, your whole life activity is a pulsation of creation of disruption, of creation of disruption, of life, other life, of being, non-being. And it is only when that rhythm is in perfect harmony that you are in the totally selfless state. And in that selflessness, the will of the divine is completely fulfilled through you, because you or I have ceased to obstruct transcendence. Link this up with what we considered yesterday regarding renunciation and relinquishment. The whole universal process is a perpetual vibrating of renunciation, relinquishment on the one hand, together with bringing into being on the other hand. And this is the nature of creation and the way the creative power acts throughout the universe and in us. This is the profoundest meaning of the word karma. It hasn't been spoken of, as far as I'm aware, either in the Upanishads or in any of the other scriptures, including the Kabbalah. So now, when that mortification aspect takes place through the perfect selflessness, through the perfect renunciation and relinquishment, this psychophysical organism itself is the body. The holy body. Those of you who are Catholics or have gone deeply into Catholicism, eat of this, for this is my body. Drink of this, for this is my blood. Blood is prana, life energy. Body is akasha. The universal plenitude out of which comes all manifestation. Be mindful then, and in that supreme mindfulness, that whole mindfulness, with the complete transformation of personal desire into this virya, this omnipotent power, non-compulsive, functioning through you. You will find then there is no place for depression, for misery. The pressures of life, the condition of the world, and we know that it is not exactly a happy condition at present right throughout the world, can bring a surface disturbance. But if you have seen, even once, really seen, and lit that light within your heart, and the hound of heaven is active inside you, you are everlastingly safe. And you will experience the reality of that extraordinary aspect of divinity, of life, of pure mind, which we call grace. And that grace will always give you the vision, the resiliency, and the strength to go through all states of depression or fear or anxiety, sorrow, whatever it is, and come back, return, be established in that perfect peace which marks true humanity. We have considered a few points in connection with pranayama, which is one of the 8 subdivisions of yoga. I think you all know that the basis of the whole of yoga, and yoga means living the religious life, is in the first 2 subdivisions, the moralities as they are called, and the religious observances. These lay the foundations for the purification of the person. And it is most significant that as far back as at least 5,000 years ago, before the Indo-Europeans began to migrate and establish themselves over the whole of Southern Asia and Europe, that the wise men, the holy ones of those days, knew yoga. And this great teaching has come down through the ages. It is most significant that this purification starts with the psyche. Morality and religious observance is a matter of the heart and the mind, not specifically of the body. And it is only afterwards that the postures and the pranayama enter into the field. Because once the mind and heart have a certain degree of purity and the strength, the power that comes through purity, then the nerves are always steady. Because the psyche affects the nerves very, very much, as you all know. Then you can train the body. After that, there come the other four stages, the pratyahara, as it is called, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. We'll deal more in detail with that a few days hence. Now we have to bear in mind that action in everyday life, bodily action, mental action, every form of action, means the utilization of energy. There can be no right utilization of energy without mindfulness. We have it in our ordinary everyday speech. A person's doing something and we say, mind what you do. You know exactly what that means. So mindfulness is an essential factor in the utilization of energy. What energy? Our own life energy. The electrochemical energy of the body is the root of the whole thing. Now this energy is squandered by mankind at what, in the terms of yogic symbolism, are called the three lower centers. The three centers at the base of the spine, at the genitals, and at the navel. Now do not think that they exist there specifically in space. This is a symbolic representation and useful as such. One associates these centers with those parts of the body. Now these three centers are concerned with the basic occupations of everyday life, which are involved in the perpetuation, in the preservation of one's own psychophysical being with the perpetuation of the species and with one's everyday activity to earn one's bread, which means commerce. So these centers are concerned with food and sex, self-perpetuation and the perpetuation of the species, self-preservation, I should say, and the perpetuation of the species, and with the everyday affairs of life. And in this aspect of the everyday affairs of life is involved what may justifiably be called digestion, which means not merely digestion of food inside the stomach and so forth, but all those activities in the world of affairs which bring about nourishment, sustenance, housing, clothing, all this will come into play. You see? Muladhara, Swadhisthana, and Manipura. Muladhara means root support. And the root support stands for this fundamental energy in itself, the electrochemical energy of the body. And it is not merely electrochemical energy, it is more than that, and the more is still, has still to be investigated by science as such. This energy manifests itself fundamentally as self-assertion in terms of Swadhisthana, and the word literally means own abode, your very own abode, and it is quite correctly associated with the genitals. Because the function of the genitals in man and woman alike express in the most intense and to the ultimate degree the assertion of self. It is the most powerful self-assertion that is possible, the sexual function. As such, the separate self function, note very carefully, which characterizes the animal world also, the whole of the animal world, in addition to ourselves who are also of animal origin. That's why it's called Swadhisthana. Sthana means established abode. Sthana, established abode. Sva means the self. And Adi means the utmost, the supreme. So that deals with food and sex. And Manipura, the digestion, also deals with food, partly, and with the commerce of everyday life, politics, economics, business, the whole caboodle. You see, Manipura deals with that. And you see what happens inside here. Things, once you eat, things begin to go round and round, and the whole business goes on like that. And the dual process takes place, finally. Assimilation, which builds, preserves, and heals, keeps strong the body, assimilation, and it has to be properly balanced by elimination, the rejection of what is not wanted by the self, and which is returned to the not-self. The different kingdoms of nature utilize that for their sustenance and so forth. So you see how the bodily process is really associated with the whole world process, intimately associated. This is, if you like, an expression of Mother Nature's ecology. We are all interdependent, interacting. If we understand this, all our misdeeds and misconceptions and wrong attitudes towards the whole question of food and sex vanish. You see at once the necessity for harmony. Because the moment you get interdependence, you must have harmony. Or else there is conflict, war, misery, pain, disease, and all the rest of it. Now, So much for the animal part of us. The animal kingdom itself cannot rise to a higher condition. We can. We are so constituted, especially with the possibilities inherent in the brain and the nervous system, and therefore also all the thought and feeling processes. We can rise higher. And that rising higher introduces the element of mindfulness in its simple kindergarten stages, ordinary observation, as we call it, like the observation of the scientist, the observation of the housewife, the observation that you and I, every one of us makes with regard to people, things, processes, and so forth. And later on, the profounder aspect of mindfulness, which we have been trying to understand, which comes through the higher centers as such. We'll deal with that at another time. But mindfulness is, again, the linchpin of the whole process. Without mindfulness, there is no liberation into this higher state. And it is only when there is this liberation into the higher state, without any discarding of what we call the lower centers, that we truly realize our manhood. And mindfulness is the linchpin of it. Now, you have heard this before, but let us just recall the real meaning of the word man. Coming from its Sanskrit root, man, from which is derived the verb manyate, meaning to think. That is the English translation. We have no words practically in any language, including Sanskrit, to express the true meaning of think in this context. It is not thinking as humanity knows thinking, which is simply discursive talking. And the discursive talk is entirely based upon sense impressions and upon that which is past, upon experience, upon accumulated knowledge. Accumulated knowledge is useful for technical purposes only, but accumulated knowledge is not wisdom. It is not insight, panya. It is not at all something which enables you to be so sensitive, so aware, that you have transcended all the limitations of the sense impressions and the speech activities, and in pure consciousness are one with that which is happening and that which is actually present here now. This thinking, this mind activity, I can only put it this way, is actually the creative energy of the universe in action. Its action takes place in eternity, in that which is immeasurable, unlimited. It is the activity of pure mind. It is creative power. And creative power in this context means continuous creation all the time. because you can't dissociate the two. It's not like in our physical world, electrical energy which is stored up, and then you turn on a switch and produce an action. The action doesn't follow the deliberate utilization of electrical or chemical or any other energy. It doesn't follow it. This creative energy is creation itself. They are absolutely synonymous. Now, man, to think, means the activity, this activity of creative energy. You know how you find in Genesis, and God said, let there be, and there was. Now that is the way that those people, the lords of the Kabbalah, expressed it. But the word they used, if I'm not mistaken, is ma'amar, the creative utterance of Elohim. You must completely divest your minds of any anthropomorphic associations with the names Elohim or Yahweh in the first five chapters of Genesis. No anthropomorphic associations at all can be allowed there. The word Elohim is compounded of Ele, the object, and me, the subject. The everlasting self-conscious life energy and the everlasting manifested energy. Take it in rather looser terms in English, matter and spirit. See? And Elohim is the complete integration of these two. And it is in the first chapter of Genesis we find Elohim said. But I would rather put it this way, having explained what is the real meaning of mind, of thought in this context, and Elohim minded. And there was. Be very careful. It's not a time process. Elohim has no brain. Elohim's minding is the actual creative process. Here now. You'll find this also in all the deepest teachings of the Upanishads, and also there are indications in the Buddhist texts, and certainly in the Zarathustrian texts too, provided one knows how to read the Zarathustrian texts. So now, the activation of the higher centers means that all this comes to life. It doesn't mean that you or I are ever going to become creative gods or something like that in the anthropomorphic sense, not at all. But it means that you and I are at last in complete line with all this. And when we are in line with all this, mindfulness in us has come to its supreme pitch. And it is perpetual all 24 hours of the day, every day of our lives. So now, with respect to this mindfulness, what is it that obstructs the mindfulness? The emergence of this kind of mindfulness, this continual awareness of the totality in creative activity. This is the important thing. What is it that obstructs? We dealt with the basic obstruction the other day, the pleasures of the senses. And we try to understand how and why that is the case, and what we mean by the pleasures of the senses in the context. Do bear in mind very carefully, I expressly mentioned there is that right pleasure, which is the gift of nature to us, which keeps the body healthy. Without that sort of pleasure, the body would never survive. The pleasure which the beauty of nature, the beauty of the life process, pours out before us. We have only to be awake to it, and we have not to grasp it, nor to seek it, nor to want its repetition, because nature never repeats herself. There is a similarity due to type, but there is no repetition in detail of the actual past. Nature has no corpses whatsoever. Everything just is immediately transformed. Nature is perpetually alive. So there is this right pleasure, this right pleasure of the senses. The song of the bird, the beauty of the sunset, the flower, the smile on the face of the baby or your friend, or your great delight when somebody unexpectedly turns up and you are just absolutely, you just absolutely go out and say, oh, how marvelous. All those are happy things, wonderful things. They are your birthright. So it's not that pleasure. It's the pleasures of the senses which are deliberately sought in order to gratify a lust for sensation. You get it? Be very discriminative and very perceptive here. So one becomes free of that sort of pleasure-seeking and self-indulging. That is one of the great obstructions. Now let us look at a few more obstructions. Out of the sense activities and the use of the speech faculty, they are coming to being our ideas, our concepts, which have their roots in our percepts. The percept is the immediate experiencing through the sense avenues. When you have experienced something several times, then a concept is formed in the mind, which enables you to recognize the percept when next you come across it. Otherwise you wouldn't know what it is. When you see something for the very first time, you say, what's that? I don't know what it is. It's a blank. You see it a second time, a third time, a thousandth time, a millionth time, and you know, yes, this is that. And you've given it a name. Now the name and the mental concept come into being out of the percepts. The percept is the living thing, the concept is the fossil, but it's a necessary fossil in order to recognize the percept. That's why it's necessary. Now our trouble is that we hold on to concepts as if they were realities. Their only reality consists in the fact that they are awful jailers of our minds. We cling to the concept. We cling to the belief, to the conviction. But it was my experience throughout my life. How can I go against that? That is the truth. How often people say, I can only speak out of my own experience. It's not necessary to say that. We know that when we speak perforce of necessity, we have no option but to speak out of our experience when we speak in the ordinary way. But if we are intelligent, we will know that yes, this is my concept born out of my own experience, my past experience, but keep the heart and the mind completely open and free. receptive, sensitive. And then you'll find that your concept changes. And the changing of that concept, which takes place, is a process of change which liberates the mind from bondage to the concept. Then you, your mind, can utilize the concept as and when necessary under a particular circumstance or in a particular situation. In other words, you mustn't grasp the concept and store it up and say, this is the truth. So you see, all our beliefs, our ideas, our conceptions, our what we call the eternal verities, which are all embodied in speech forms. Don't forget the tremendous power of speech, and you'll appreciate more and more now why I say shut up and don't talk. I should apply that to myself, of course. You see? All these are our bondage. They are not our bondage insofar as the harmonious life confined to the three lower centers is concerned. Food, sex, and the commerce of everyday life, which will include science and art and philosophy and everything. But they are our obstructors where this release into full manhood, which is identical with full divinity, is concerned. The wonderful phrase in the Bible, and the manhood was taken up into the Godhead. So now, since all these are derived from our life here, within the sphere of the three lower centers, as we call them, we have to learn to put aside, I'm using the Buddhist phrase for the moment, to put aside all these things. And as the Buddhist teaching stands, it is presented very briefly as follows. Exercising mindfulness, or in meditation, specific meditation, this sort of discursive meditation we talked of day before yesterday, we raise up before the mind a particular subject of meditation and so forth, then we see certain things about it, and we see that everything is relative, anicca, or if you like, impermanent. It's relative. It is not changeless, eternal reality, anatta. And it is the source of dukkha, the ill state. The ill state meaning not merely painful, unpleasant, or disagreeable, and so forth, but meaning fundamentally far from the infinite, far from truth, the absolute truth, which is ungraspable, which cannot be confined, which is that state of consciousness where you are aware of the continuous change of the universe, which takes place through the universal process. And so the bhikkhu is told, seeing this in relationship to every shape that comes up, every object, every body, and so forth, in relation to all the feelings, in relation to all the ideas and thoughts, the sannyā, in relation to all the sankhara, the the mental patterns, the mental conceptions, the systems of philosophy, and so forth and so forth. All these are sankhara. With respect to discriminative consciousness itself, which is a very important statement, extremely important statement, seeing that they are all impermanent or relative, they are not the ultimate reality, and they are far from the infinite, put them aside. Now the question arises, well, how do you put it aside? You can't put it aside like contemplating the third bottle of whiskey which is before you now, having finished the first two, and say, I will put this aside, and you take it and hide it in the cupboard. You can't put it aside like that. You try. We talk about the disciplines. Do we ever really try them? I mean, seriously try them. Put real sweat and blood and tears and toil into the thing. That's another matter. Try it. You can't just discard it. I've tried it again and again through the years, and I know what happens. All you do is you push it into another corner of the mind. Or you struggle against it, you try to destroy it. This is false. This is not real. This does not lead to nirvana. Therefore, out with it. You fight against it. But in that activity of violence upon your own mind, you have not done the real thing. That same energy, which this misshapen energy is still there, still a source of sorrow and evil and so forth, in broken fragments. But in this case, unlike a vase which falls down and is shattered, every one of those fragments is alive and active, and all the more difficult to deal with. You cannot destroy your life energy in any shape or form, and you shouldn't try to. That is a suicidal action. Not commendable. You have to transform it. You have to take this ill expression of your life energy, this misshapen form, and change it into the similitude of eternal beauty. This is the meaning of putting it aside. How do you do it? Again, try and divest the mind of our physical experience and physical analogies. We can take some object which is pliable. It has to be somewhat pliable, and bend it and twist it and change it and paint it and all the rest of it and make it beautiful instead of being such an ugly object in front of us. We can do that with a physical object. What is it that transforms this psychical and psycho-spiritual energy in us, which takes its takes shape in terms of our beliefs and convictions and dogmas and doctrines and all the rest of it? How do we transform it? This is where the spiritual alchemy of intense mindfulness comes in. And the intensity of the mindfulness demands extraordinary energy. Virya, as taught in all the religions. I'm using the word virya, I'm using these Pali terms because so many of you are, if not all of you, are well acquainted with these terms particularly. this extraordinary energy is in you. It functions if you refuse to fight against that which you want to transform into beauty. Don't say this is ugly and fight against it. Try to destroy it. Look at it. Look at it quietly. Keep looking at it. Anything in my mind will never continue to remain ill or harmful if I keep looking at it steadily. This is the magic. It is because we get tired of looking, we get frightened of looking, we get depressed and hurt with the looking. Believe me, I know a little bit of what it means to look into all that is inside this cesspool of the unconscious, as we call it, or the subconscious. It's a horrible stink. But keep looking at it. I've used the word cesspool. But look at nature. Whence does the beauty of tree and flower and fruit come? Part of that is due to the fact that that which is a cesspool for one kingdom of nature is the very thing that undergoes transformation, this alchemy, this marvelous magic of the universal process. And lo, there is beauty and perfume. So, this is the alchemy, the power, the alchemical power within us. Keep looking at it. It will transform. Don't apply any will to it. Remember what I said. Omnipotence is non-compulsive. No compulsion about it. Infinite patience. It will draw out your loving kindness and your mercy and your compassion. If you cannot be compassionate to yourself, you will everlastingly be cruel and hurtful to others around. Don't be self-pitying either. Now, when you look, beware of indulging yourself through the act of looking, saying, oh, this will now transform into something very marvelous and wonderful, and we'll have a happy time. That is self-indulgence and a frightful illusion. Perhaps one of the outstanding examples of that, especially in our lives during the period from the approach of puberty till our sexual functions have ceased to torment us and desires. Now there's something which comes up in mind again and again. Watch your fantasies. Watch all the fantasies of impossible delights which you might or could enjoy sexually. You express not only your passion for pleasure, but also your ego. The supreme egoistic triumph is the sexual fulfillment as conceived by the intellect at work, making all sorts of impossibly wonderful shapes. The whole thing is sheer nonsense. Don't be such a fool. So you see, there is a marvelous example there. There are other examples. The fantasies of power. I shall do this and I shall do that. I shall be the greatest pianist in the world, and so forth and so on. You see, all this absurd. I shall make £1,000,000. I want to make £1,000,000. Oh, of course, not for myself, but the marvelous good things I can do with that £1,000,000. If I was such a confounded idiot as to desire £1,000,000 so passionately, there is not the slightest ground for believing that I know anything at all about helping others in the right way with my £1,000,000 when I've made it. And I'll make it by evil means. These are the facts of life. We must face them completely. Understand this, and you will understand why the great teachers taught poverty, chastity, not masochistic abstention from sex. But no, I am going to be a celibate. I am determined to be a celibate because that is the way I shall attain arhantship, sit on the right hand of the Father, be recognized as a saint and be worshipped, and I'll be delegated with wonderful spiritual potencies by the Lord God himself in order to help other celibates to be just as big fools as I was. No, I'm saying these things rather fiercely, rather harshly maybe, because we really must drive home right into our minds. Just blow open all the doors that hide the light, that prevent the light from entering. Look into these fantasies and so forth. And look at them, and beware of indulging them in the act of looking. Especially the fantasies of sexual enjoyment and power. The power lust. Those are the two most powerful, I think. So you see, just look. Neither resist nor indulge. And this is the individual problem. You have to just be on the lookout. Be patient, be kind with yourself, but be uncompromisingly honest with yourself. Seeing the fact as the fact, and the power to see the fact as the fact will grow and grow and grow. At first it is impossible, of course. Otherwise, having heard this now, from the next moment onwards, you could do it. But you can't. Here there is a good analogy with physical things. You like to play tennis. You have some gift along that line. But you can't immediately become top champion at Wimbledon. Practice, practice, practice like anything. Or if you have a gift as a musician or a painter or whatever it is, you can't immediately become a Titian or a Beethoven or whatever it is. You just can't. 5% inspiration, 95% perspiration. As far as my little experience in life goes, it's 99.999% perspiration and hardly one that the remainder inspiration. But that is how it is. Now, keep looking without desire for any result. Because if you look out for a result, you will not be putting it aside. You will not be freeing yourself from the bondage of the limited. And you will not realize the infinite. The wings of the bird of the spirit will not lift you off earth. Give yourself to it. Give yourself to the task. And you can't give yourself to the task unless you have love. The love which comes into being when desire is transcended. When desire is completely transcended, then this divine will, this omnipotence of the creative energy of the universe functions through you. And when that creative power functions through you, coupled with your love, which completely gives yourself that you, so that you are selfless, lo and behold, Eros and Psyche are in eternal union, the purified Psyche, the marriage made in heaven, and now functioning continuously on earth, the purified Psyche with this creative power functioning through it. And then whatsoever that happens through you in terms of action will be right and proper. And it will be religious, in the supreme sense of the word religious. So this is how you begin to put aside things. That is to say, it is transformed. Till at last you are free from ill. The state of freedom from illness is functioning through you. And that, which is a non-grasping state, is the actual state of nirvana here, now.